You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation with John Best.
Welcome to another edition of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati. On behalf of the Best Innovation Group, where we like to do cool things with financial technology for credit unions, banks, fintech companies. And speaking of cool things with technology, this week I think we've got a really good one that will hopefully both at the same time entertain you and scare the crap out of you, which that's not my phrase. I'm basically paraphrasing from what a couple of the credit union executives who were in the audience in the town hall session that we're excerpting these this conversation from said. We're going to be speaking with Alyssa Knight, who is a, as she calls it herself, a recovering hacker, a white hat hacker, I guess would be the term that I would apply to it, who has been in the space for some time. And one of her claims to fame is that she had hacked into 30 banks within a single week. In the not-too-distant past, in 2019, and she's going to be talking about vulnerabilities, what we should be looking for, specifically with a credit union spin on that, and specifically around mobile apps, and a little bit about connected cars and the Internet of Things, which is another one of her areas of expertise. So we're going to be jumping into that very shortly. Before, let me just remind you that you can always track us down here on the Big Cast with new content. Every Tuesday, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, etc. Or you can go straight to the company website, to the Best Innovation Group, big-fintech.com, where you'll find a lot of other great information, including a way to access these digital town halls that take place every Wednesday that I mentioned is the original source of the excerpts we're going to be playing from Alyssa. You can also track down the Best Innovation Group on Twitter, at Big Fintech. Let me do our usual kind of around the horn with some of the current events and recent breaking news in the fintech space before we jump in. And financial, we've covered that topic before. The IPO that wasn't, what would look like it was going to be the largest IPO ever, as recently as right around Election Day, and then wound up getting pulled back. New developments on that front. Ant Financial has agreed to become basically a bank holding company under the full regulatory structure of the Chinese government in terms of the way they deal with banks and financial service providers. In the process of doing so, this has basically slashed the anticipated valuation of Ant by about two-thirds. The expectation earlier was that they would be worth over $300 billion when they went public. Now it's expected to be someplace more in the $100 billion range. Still not chump change, but a very different story. Very telling in terms of where we're going, both in terms of governmental relations, regulatory oversight, not just in China, but more globally in general. And certainly the game is not over yet. There's no IPO mentioned at this stage. I think there's still some shakeout. This is all still on the reported stage. I don't think it's all the details have entirely been worked out. I'm not exactly sure Jack Ma was working from the greatest position to strengthen this negotiation either. Some more to come on that one, but interesting developments there. Another piece of headlines this week, UK regulators are going after the buy now, pay later space, taking a closer look at what that means in terms of consumers' awareness and any potential vulnerabilities on the consumer side. Some reports, I haven't actually been able to substantiate these, but I've just read this in a couple of different press reports, that there are estimates that as much as 20% of Christmas shopping in the UK spent on through buy now, pay later may now have consumers in financial stress and lack of ability to pay those back. Interesting space. It's one of these buy now, pay later companies like Klarna and Affirm and household names taken off even more rapidly in the European markets where credit card spending culture is not quite as prevalent. It's a great solution, particularly for larger ticket items and particularly for people who either don't have a credit card, prefer not to use them, or just don't have access to the sufficient balance headroom for a larger purchase. And like a lot of these things, from my standpoint, a really good idea for a niche solution, and when you put it on steroids and try to really extend it to a much broader reach in the marketplace, has some really questionable, I'll just use that word, questionable impacts downstream. At this point, this is only a story in the UK. I could certainly see it extending more through the EU, and don't be surprised, particularly with the new administration and the new sheriff in town at the CFPB, that we may be hearing more about that here in the US as well. Another piece of news, CUNA's latest information, a year-end wrap-up and some economic reporting shows the slowest loan growth for credit unions over the course of the last 5 years. Not terribly surprising, given what we've gone through over the course of at least the last 9 months of 2020. Mortgages have been a saving grace, but even some of those refinances and things like that have been slowing down to some extent. Auto lending, also an interesting one. I'm looking forward to, transitioning over to a couple of the upcoming events in the space here in the financial services industry. Looking forward to hear Mike Schenck, the chief economist of CUNA, as well as Jordan Van Rien and their economic shop, always do a great update, their economic update that takes place during their government affairs conference, the GAC, every year, usually in Washington, D.C. Of course, this year it will be virtual. So I'm looking forward. I'm sure he'll get into more detail on that. So if you haven't already taken a look into GAC, you don't have to travel this year. March 2nd through 4th, we'll post the link if you want to track that down. And Mike and Jordan are always very gracious and often follow up with us with a brief interview for the podcast. So I'm looking forward to talking to them as well and seeing where they see this going. It's, again, thinking back just about a year, it was the last business trip I took in late February to D.C., and, there were already just enough gathering storm clouds that they were caveating a lot of their statements around what was still a pretty rosy picture with, clouds on the horizon even before the pandemic. And obviously the world changed rather dramatically within a couple of weeks after they gave their usual annual report. So it'll be interesting to see what they have to say after a course of another year looking at that. Speaking of another conference that I think is worth you looking into, the Future of Cash, a group put on by a couple of different sponsors, one of which is Cash Essentials, and their head, Guillaume Lepec, has been a friend of the podcast and has been on before. This is, a virtual event taking place. If you're listening to this soon after we post it, you've still got a chance to check it out, February 17th and 18th. It's actually based out of Europe and therefore running on the European calendar and time zones. Therefore, for me here on the East Coast, rather, I think my starting time is 6 a.m. for some of these sessions, but I'm sure they'll be available on demand after the fact if you're not up for the early wake-up call. They are also going to be still attempting to do their annual in-person on-site conference in Madrid later in the year. Currently, I think that's scheduled for early November. But I find this stuff really interesting. Obviously, the use of cash has a many-faceted kind of conversation in play around the various trends. Obviously, cash usage dropping for the most part, although I think that's often exaggerated, varies dramatically by country. Even the supposedly often hyped kind of cash-free societies, which are often in the Nordics, when you really drill down in the details, there's still cash there too. We've also got the Fed has talked about the drop-off in cash usage in the U.S., particularly pandemic-related. But again, even the Fed's data has shown that if you take a look at the trend in spending and the extent to which the things that have been shut down are the in-site locational, point-of-sale purchases. Those are the ones where you use cash. Of course cash is going to go down if you're not buying things in person. Now, the next question is, does cash return when point-of-sale spending returns? And if point-of-sale spending doesn't return, I think we've got a much bigger issue that we have to be dealing with as well. So I think there's a really good conversation to be had here. And it varies a little bit geographically, but it'll be a great one. And my experience is there's a really good conversation that takes place in the chat window at these conferences that Cash Essentials is involved with as well. We've also obviously got in the U.S. things like city ordinances, which have now really pushed back on cash-free point of sale, that to make sure that people, from a financial inclusion standpoint, people are not excluded, and therefore it in many municipalities it's become required to accept cash at the point of sale. Anyway, Future of Cash Conference, February 17th and 18th, if you want to check it out. And I've actually posted a blog this week about the what I call the future and the past of cash. We'll post a link to that on the big website as well if you'd like to take a look. Anyway, back to our main attraction, Alyssa Knight, a recovering hacker, as she calls herself. She is also, since kind of going legit, she has started and sold two cybersecurity companies. Her emphasis, for the most part, is on embedded systems hacking, and that's why the Tesla reference in the headline. She's worked in a lot of Internet of Things kind of embedded devices. As she points out, if you've got a car that's been bought just in the last few years, you're dealing with a connected vehicle, whether you think of it that way or not. And she's often brought in by companies to find vulnerabilities. I mean, again, the whole white hat concept, which is a really important role that people play. You need folks who understand where the bodies are buried, so to speak, to really get at this stuff. And some great perspectives, far-reaching conversation. Let's have a listen.
Just to let everyone know, I've been a hacker for 20 years. Typical Hollywood story. I started hacking when I was 13 and was arrested for hacking into a government network when I was 17. I started and sold several cybersecurity startups, started my first company when I was 17 and sold it to a public company when I was 20. Sold my second startup when I was 27. I'm in the middle of a third exit, on my, MSSP. A few years ago, I moved to Germany. I was relocated there by a large automaker who wanted me to hack their fleet of connected cars. So I really over the past few years, became known for hacking into embedded systems. It's something I like to do. If any of you are familiar with me or follow me, I have a YouTube channel, and you can see videos of me hacking a bank through the CCTV cameras in the parking lot. Some other hijinks, I guess, as well as videos on me hacking cars. Have I hacked a Tesla, John? No. I was invited though to for this $1 million Tesla challenge to hack a Tesla though, but a lot of people think that they're impervious to being hacked because of the fact that, they're not driving around in a Tesla, but a lot of people don't know is that any car made after 2001 is connected. It communicates over GSM. If any of you saw my video that got published last week, I published actually two trailers where law enforcement retained me to hack law enforcement vehicles and found a way to remotely stop and start the engine of law enforcement vehicles, both federal and state, as well as lock and unlock the doors, which of course could be something that wouldn't be all that great if you have a perp in the back. One of the things that you did bring up during my introduction is my experience in hacking banks. I have actually been retained by multiple credit unions in performing penetration testing or ethical hacking of their APIs. As a lot of you know, APIs are really the plumbing of our financial system and our financial infrastructure. And unfortunately, a lot of banks, a lot of credit unions don't know how to properly secure them. They treat them like web servers and they try and secure them with web application firewalls. And a lot of my findings in hacking bank APIs or financial services APIs or fintech, if you will, is that the APIs are not properly authorized, meaning that if I have a valid JOT token or a valid token as a credit union customer, I was able to, and there's actually a video of this on my YouTube channel if you want to see it, where I hacked a large credit union doing this, where I logged in with my account and was able to change the PIN code of any credit union customer and also move money in and out of accounts. So without authentication, obviously without even having to be on the other account, I could just specify any account number at the credit union.
Stop you just for a second. You can't say things like that because we have to get a defibrillator ready for Tom. You saw just a minute ago, he kind of like
no heart attacks, Tom.
Yeah, I don't want him to. Yeah,
Here's the scary thing. When I reported the findings, and obviously these were all sanctioned, when we reported the findings, it turns out that and I actually was surprised to hear this. I thought all credit unions really wrote their own mobile apps, but from my experience, a lot of credit unions outsource the development of their mobile apps. And when I met with the company that they outsourced to, it turns out that the vulnerabilities were systemic across every credit union, every bank that they wrote mobile apps for. So this one credit union where I thought the vulnerabilities were localized, it turns out it affected over 100 credit unions. It was awful. And I think, therein lies the problem where you know, yeah, if you outsource the development of your mobile app, it's most likely going to, you'll find that the vulnerabilities are systemic across all of the customers that they create apps for, because they rinse and reuse code. So
yeah, we have seen that actually in the mid 2000s, 2008, as we headed to 2010, hacker rings identify problems with specific mobile apps. And as you might imagine, it's trivial to go into the store and just look for where the colors changed and the logo changed, but the menu item and the aesthetics are the same. And right. Then you can surmise. And oftentimes they made it even worse, where the publisher of the app, even though the credit union has the app, if you look at the publisher, it's actually the corporation or the company that's providing the software. But interestingly enough, by and large, it's very few credit unions actually in the system. And when I started in credit unions in 1996, there were approximately 20,000 credit unions. Today, Tom, there's about 5,000-ish, somewhere in there. So about 5,000-ish. And of them, I would say maybe 150 might have written their own mobile app.
I mean, we're so small that we don't have the resources of staffing to write our own apps. And so we all seem to be buying from the same handful of developers out there. If you find a vulnerability in one, it's probably pretty systemic across the network. Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely scared Jonathan. He had to leave. Clearly, he had to go change his shorts, I think, when you said that you got in, changed pins, as well as transferred money. I mean, when you say for our team, when you say JWT token, you mean JWT, which is a JavaScript web token that's commonly used by mobile apps to log into a backend.
Correct. Right. It's developers. It's one of many options you can use to, try and authenticate sessions. Basically, once you specify username and password, you're issued a token, as you mentioned, a JWT token. And that JWT token, its payload can contain numerous things. But I've seen implementations for some credit unions where there were no tokens. They were just using cookies. It's just a failure to authenticate and authorize. And that's another issue is my findings that a lot of developers don't understand the distinction between authentication and authorization. Authenticating who you are, what you know, what you have, versus whether or not you're authorized to actually see it. And when you're issuing a mobile app account or a login to customers, to anyone with a bank account, you need to be very careful of what are called broken object level authorization vulnerabilities, or BOLA. They used to be called indirect object reference, insecure direct object reference, but they're now called BOLA vulnerabilities. But basically what to give you my modus operandi for how I do this, how I hack banks and credit unions, is I'll take your mobile app, and a lot of credit unions don't implement what's called certificate pinning, and I'll actually insert myself in the communication between your mobile app and the back end. And a lot of credit unions will think, we've made sure to check for jailbroken or rooted devices, so we're secure. And a lot of people don't understand, hackers don't really need to run your app on a jailrooted phone I don't need to do that. All I need to do is run it on my iPhone or run it on my Android and use an SSL man in the middle, or what I call woman in the middle attack tool, and interdict that traffic and decrypt it and see what your mobile app is doing. And then once I get those API calls, I then feed them into a separate application that I have, which is just a free API client. And a lot of times credit unions will put the member ID in the URL or the URI, or my user ID, whatever. Usually it's a string of numbers and it corresponds to the member ID. And that leaves it open to BOLA vulnerabilities, where if I change my member ID to a different member ID, that will typically give me the ability to perform actions as that other member, credit union member, because they're only looking to make sure you have a token. They're only looking to make sure that you've been authenticated and you should be sending this API request. So I think there's a lot of, it's almost like we've gone back 20 years, because a lot of You know, back 20 years ago, we were hard coding usernames and passwords in source code. I'm still finding that in fintech and financial services mobile apps. Developers hard coding keys, hard coding API tokens, hard coding credentials into their mobile apps. And it's really easy to extract that app off of the device and reverse engineer it and gain access to all those hard coded keys and tokens.
What do you do if you're an organization, you know, just to answer Tom's question. So you're in a position where, you know, you just can't afford to have a team of developers, particularly to compete with the Joneses, right? The bar is pretty high. And our competitors, we don't consider them other credit. We consider them the Chimes of the world, which, by the way, go after Chime. I'd love to see what you find. You know, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, those kinds of guys who have infinite resources. So the only way to keep up from a service perspective is to enter into these one-to-many type relationships with digital services providers. So what advice do you have? I mean, obviously you have to hold them accountable. And I bet what they told you was, oh, we just can't go and fix that. It'll take, you know, 10 years. And you're the only one that's ever found it. So it's not a big deal, even though, you know, we probably both could run a log. And I bet, if put it this way, I like to think I'm not that smart. If I can think of it, someone's done it. So my thought is, if you found it, someone's exploited it. It's a zero day for somebody somewhere on the dark web for that particular credit. And once they figure out it's all of them, it's going to be a big deal. So what do they do? What are your thoughts on that?
So, you know, I've never believed that there was a single silver bullet in security. I think I take a layered onion approach, right? You have your crown jewels that you need to protect for credit unions. It's an obvious answer. And then you build your defensive controls around that on what you're trying to protect. The fact of the matter is you're going to get breached. No CISO out there who knows what they're doing is ever going to go to a board of directors and say that I'm going to prevent us from getting hacked, because it's going to happen. We've now moved this from this narrative of intrusion prevention, history has proven is not possible, to intrusion detection, and being able to lower that mean time to detection, catch the adversary sooner rather than months later. My recommendation is that credit unions definitely trust but verify. The other thing is, you know, if you're outsourcing the development of code, yeah, trust that they're taking, you know, security into consideration, and they've shifted it left, and it's being implemented as the code is being written. But verify that, you know, they are actually writing secure code. If they tell you that they're doing penetration testing, you know, don't stake your job on the fact that they're doing a thorough job or even doing it. Ask for, you know, copies of penetration test reports if you don't want to do your own pen testing. But I would always, always perform my own pen testing, even if the outsourcer supplier says they're doing it. Do static and dynamic code analysis. So even though you're hiring a penetration tester to hack your APIs in your mobile app, perform static and dynamic code analysis. Actually have the code looked at and scanned. Anyone who you've retained to do a pen test can also do static and dynamic code analysis for you. So, you know, you're getting that human adversary testing with the penetration test, and with static and dynamic code analysis, you're importing that code into a tool to be also looked at. I would also change your penetration tester up. You know, unfortunately, I find a lot of organizations get comfortable with their penetration tester and they keep rehiring them over and over again. And that doesn't make sense to me, because they're learning where the bodies are buried. They're learning, they're becoming too familiar with the infrastructure and the assets, and they're falling asleep at the wheel. And they know what to test every single year. And so change it up, bring in a new pen tester. If John and I are both performing a pen test of Jonathan's network, he and I are both going to come up with completely different results. We may both be pen testers for the last 20 years. We both may be OSCP certified, but he's going to color outside different lines than I am. So treat up your penetration testers that you're hiring every year and bring in some fresh blood when you do that. You know,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
That is a great point. So I want to ask a quick question. Hey, Jonathan, do you have access? If you said to, I want to name the company, I forget what your mobile company is, but if you said to XYZ company, hey, I want to dynamically and statically, I need your code. Do you have access to do that?
No, not today.
I don't know of any credit union so they claim that they do that, Alyssa. And we get, generally they do, the only thing we usually have access to is an escrow. So if it is that they go out of business or something, you would get right. The code and theoretically could continue to move on. But right. Generally, we get nothing. And so I would just say for anyone that's on here, Tom, can you validate a similar position as far as you know?
Yeah, just like you said, our source code for our core system is in escrow, so we have access to that. But I don't know if that gives us access to what we need to do the testing Alyssa's talking about. But
if you outsource it and you're not able to get your hands on source code, it's you know, the next best thing is to just grab the app off of your device after downloading it from the App Store and then taking the object code and running that through something like MobSF, which is a free tool. And what it does is, I would be surprised if they did code obfuscation. They probably aren't. You just roll that APK file into MobSF, and MobSF will actually decompile it for you, and it'll reverse it all the way back to the original code, which is how I find hard-coded keys and tokens and passwords. So, again, you're going to want someone who can actually look at that and make sense of it, but it does give you a really sexy GUI to just kind of drag and drop the APK file into the tool.
So one issue we have is, believe it or not, and I know I'm not trying to keep raining on your parade, but believe it or not, they prohibit. So like if Jonathan did that in his contract, if Jonathan did it, not you, and he did that and he pointed out that there was a problem in the APK code, their first question would be, okay, well, you violated your terms of service with us. But it's a good point because we need to look into our contracts. The point I'm making here is you bring up, I think, the most important point. We're contractually stuck in this and we need to start thinking more security minded and holding these folks. And just a SOC 2 isn't enough. That's what we find is they'll hang their hat on some sort of cert, usually a SOC 2, something that they've gotten certified by, some group. And also there's penalty in terms of, a lot, not indemnity and what's not in there. So they take a lot of that risk. So that's kind of why you do it. But it doesn't change the fact that no matter what anybody thinks, if Hudson Valley suddenly had that situation that you described, no one's going to blame his provider. They're going to blame Hudson Valley. It's a reputational loss.
Yeah. This is why John, in our case, I mean, I know every provider is different, but we do take a fair, I mean, we don't have access directly to the source code, and I don't expect that our digital banking partner would necessarily provide that to any of their clients unless they went out of business, like you said. But, we've made it very clear to them that, every year we have a third party security a consultancy go through and run a complete, set of tests against the applications and the files they have. And they are, every year we submit a list of things that say, hey, you need to address these based on our independent audits of your applications and your web platform based on what we were able to find. I think that for us, we might be in a smaller subset of credit unions, especially, and probably larger credit unions that sort of force this upon our vendors. I don't know if some smaller credit unions have the same degree of clout with basically being able to say, we're going to do this whether you like it or not. But I know for us, that has been the approach we take, because honestly, we're never going to trust somebody 100% to have done everything right the first time or found everything the first time.
Yeah. So, and one of the things, and just to respond to that and what John said, I, compliance doesn't equal security. Just because your digital banking supplier is providing a SOC 2 Type 2 report or even an ISO certification, compliance does not equal security. They can be, I mean, look at the Target breach, right? I mean, they were PCI certified. Yeah. You know,
it's never HVAC certified.
Yeah, I mean, it's two different things. You know, there's secure and then there's compliant. You know, and so, you know, my recommendation is, much to Jonathan's point, is, you know, yeah, we understand that you're doing this and we understand you're writing secure code, but, you know, at the end of the day, if we get breached, it's not their logo that's going to be on the news. It's your credit union's logo and it's your job, right? So, you know, I don't know. I mean, humans are writing the code, and you know, we like I said, we are the weakest link in security. And you know, until computers can write their own code, there's going to be problems in that code. There's going to be vulnerabilities, and it's you know, the only way to really find those is through ongoing continuous testing. So yeah, I definitely endorse you guys continuing to do that.
So I want to shift gears, because the thing you said earlier, like I said, it almost knocked Tom out of his chair. How did you get into the bank or the credit union or whatever financial institution it was from the CCTV? Is it a target hack?
Yeah. So, I'm a influencer, cybersecurity influencer and content creator, YouTuber. And so one of my clients, I'm sure you guys have heard of them, Sentinel One, was is releasing an IoT security product, and they wanted a white paper on how their product works. And I'm a big believer in Simon Sinek's, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And so the kind of content I create is really a blending of hacking and content creation. So I take my experience as a hacker and I hack something or blow something up and show how their product would have prevented it, to prove the efficacy of the product, that the product actually says what the marketing material says it does. And so what I did was I told Sentinel, hey, you know, why don't we do this? If you're an IoT security product, I have this relationship with this bank. I know that they have CCTV cameras in their parking lot. What if I were to pull my car up into the parking lot and hack that bank through their cameras from my car? And that's exactly what I did. So what happened was the bank had all of its CCTV cameras and facilities equipment on the same network as the bank, as their banking systems. It was one big flat network. And this is 2020, right? You know, this was like last year. And, you know, even though we've been spanked so many times about, you know, flat networks and the importance of a micro-segmentation and isolation, we're still not doing it. And I think a lot of the times it's because these banks and credit unions have been around for a while, and the idea of, you know, really tearing the network apart and trying to implement micro-segmentation on something that's been there for decades, or, you know, it's daunting to think about. And so, you know, unfortunately, a lot of facilities, networking equipment like HVAC, CCTV cameras, door locking mechanisms and systems are connected now. And they're all on the same network, and many times is critical banking systems or, you know, servers. Excuse me. I was trying to hold that sneeze back. My COVID's acting up.
Too long, bad things happen.
Sorry. You know, so unfortunately, this is still common practice, and the CCTV cameras had implemented web, and I was obviously, it was either web or WPA, but ended up cracking the key. And so there was a vulnerability on the CCTV camera that allowed me to do remote code execution. And so I gained a shell on the camera and just set up a Netcat listener and pivoted right into the bank. And so, I mean, you know, it's scary. I didn't even have to walk into the branch. I just sat in my car and people
didn't even have to climb the pole, right?
Thanks again. That one I find just fascinating. I mean, this, I am not a hacker. I am not even terribly technically proficient when it comes to the coding side of things. But this stuff is as I think you can hear from the folks who chimed in along the way from the credit union side, Tom O'Shea and Jonathan Silley's voice you heard along with John Best's in this one. A lot of concern and diligence and interest going into exactly what this means for their operations. Alyssa's very active in social media. If you've been interested in this, well, first off, I'll say that this was excerpts. There's a lot more good stuff where that came from in the town hall session that ran about an hour with her back a couple weeks ago from the Best Innovation Group. We'll post that link on the website too, so you can listen to the whole thing if you so choose, including more conversation around connected devices and automobiles, et cetera, and hacking potential in those kind of spaces. She's also very active on YouTube. She has a YouTube channel, a new book out as well that I think is worth checking out. And we'll have links to all of those posted on the website. And again, if you're interested, take a look at the website. You can ask for an invitation and join the town halls, which take place every Wednesday, about lunchtime on the West Coast, a little bit later in the afternoon on the East Coast. Great information gathering, sharing of best practices in the credit union space. So if you're interested in that, if you're so inclined, take a look. Even if you're not inclined, why don't you go ahead and take a look at the big website, big-fintech.com. My name is Glenn Sarvati. You can track me down at my firm name, 154 Advisors. Best way is probably on Twitter, at 154 Advisors. You can certainly find me on LinkedIn as well. Just don't spell my name wrong like about 75% of the people do. You'll find me Sarvady. With that, as I say, we got lots of great stuff coming up. We'll be focusing on some of the outputs of that Future of Cash conference, CUNA GAC, and a lot of other great stuff coming up over the next couple weeks. Subscribe if you are so inclined. Check the website if you're so inclined. As always, thanks for listening.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech. Email us at info@big-fintech.com. Or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.